Hi, this is Paul. I woke up this morning and thought, I got to make a video about what I'm hearing in terms of Jordan Peterson and men finding relief from depression. I was even thinking about the word healing because it is so strange. And yet it is something that over the last course of the year has become so obvious to me through lots of conversations and lots of emails from people. So just to recap a little bit of my story with Jordan Peterson, he first caught my attention during the C-16 thing, and I was most interested in the theological aspect of his work, and I noticed he was addressing the split world. And at that point, I really didn't have any inkling about how split the world was in many different ways. In the last video I made on Boltman and Axial Age, some of the Axial Age videos I've been doing on Verveke's work. So I've been talking a lot about the split world, and I've spoken about that in a lot of my videos. I saw people showing an interest in Christianity from groups I wouldn't expect. Generally speaking, once I saw people go down the road to Sam Harris and New Atheism or post-Christian New Age religions, once people would go down those roads, usually didn't see them come back. It was pretty much a one-way street. And after Jordan Peterson caught my attention, I started paying a little bit of attention, started reading some Reddit and YouTube comments and Facebook group comments. I began to see all of these people who had an interest in Christianity. And I thought, this is really weird. And so, of course, I dug into Peterson and, well, do you believe in God? Well, I act as if God exists. Well, what kind of answer is that? And what on earth do you mean by that? So I just kept digging and digging and digging. And I was blogging about him, having trouble, like many people, finding conversation partners to talk about Peterson. I mean, who wants to talk about this crazy guy and out of Toronto? And who's going to sit down and listen to a two-hour video if you're not already disposed to hearing it? And so on and so forth. And so I decided something's going on with this YouTube thing. And I had an itch to play around more with YouTube, and I really wanted to understand Peterson and what was going on, and I really wanted some more conversation partners, so I made a video. And the video I made was dramatically more successful than any other video I had ever made, and any other blog post that I had ever written, and before you knew it, I had way more conversation partners than I had time to manage. And then the email started flowing in, and the personal stories. And again, what I was interested in is I wanted to talk to people and ask them questions. When did you first start listening to Jordan Peterson? Why did he have your interest? What changes did that make in your life? And the stories just kept coming in. And the more stories that would come in, the more patterns started to develop. And so I was talking to people, and I began hearing a fair amount of, not really repetition, but the patterns were becoming clear the more people I would talk to. And I started recording some of these conversations with people's permission. And then I started posting some of these conversations with people's permission. And then I began seeing that I was actually, through posting these conversations, developing a sense of community just in the chat room in my channel, and that it was a lot of fun for people to listen to other people that they had been chatting with in the comments section tell their stories and share their stories and share their thoughts and ideas. And as a pastor, of course, I know that this is similar to what we do in church, but it's different because we're doing it on YouTube, so it isn't exactly church, but there are some similar dynamics. But again, the patterns kept revealing themselves. And obviously, there's a Christian side of this for me, that people's renewed interest in Christianity and the Bible. I saw that a lot of people were having difficulty finding churches in real life and pastors that they could relate to. And I know finding churches and pastors can be a very daunting thing. So who is going to care for these people? I'm a pastor, so, well, maybe I should help. And so, of course, that started this process for me. But a big piece of this that I haven't talked a lot about is the healing side of this. People would tell me stories that would sound, and you can find some of these in my conversations. I think about Dennis from the Netherlands and Job. People would start telling me stories that would sound downright miraculous. that people had been struggling with depression and with depression, anxiety sometimes, tried all sorts of things. And then suddenly they found Jordan Peterson, and especially when they started listening to the biblical series, bang, it was like relieved. And all of these stories are within context. Some people were working on their diet and working on exercise and working with traditional medical, you know, doctors and hospitals and psychologists and whatnot. I got to be careful about what I say here, because this little internet, the literal internet, people just run away with things. But as a pastor, I began to find these stories remarkable. And again, miracle is not too strong a word in some of these cases. And what a strange thing it is that people would sit down and, you know, you can listen to the biblical series. They're all out there. They don't cost you anything. You know, it's not like putting a drug in your body. Or people are sitting and listening to these talks and they are changing. What's up with that? That is remarkable. And that is something that the more I listen to it, the more I see it, the more people come to me with their testimonies, I say, this is something I shouldn't just run by. Oh, there's a burning bush, but there's this sheep I got to catch. So, you know, let the bush burn. No, stop. Look, what's going on? Is this holy ground? Should I take off my shoes? What's going on with this crazy Canadian psychologist that has a voice like Kermit? Why are miracles, in a sense, happening to people listening to his videos? Now, many people go down the Jordan Peterson rabbit hole, and there's a sense of addiction early on, and I can relate to that because I'm sort of like that, because once I found the biblical series, then it was like waiting for every week for the next one to come out, or every month for the next one to come out, and oh shoot, they've got to wait for another biblical series. They might as well get through Maps of Meaning. I might as well get through Personalities. Oh, look, there are older versions of these classes. I should look at those. And oh, there's a reading list. I should look at that. And oh, these are the people that he's talking about. I should dig into them. So there's an addiction to this, and I was not suffering from depression. But I got hooked and I went down the rabbit hole and there I was. And now, unlike some individuals who, like Owen Benjamin, who bit hard and then bit back, I don't have any sense of that I was fooled. He's never offered me anything that he just always does what he does. And if you don't want to give the man a dime, don't give the man a dime. It's the videos, he puts it out there. He doesn't even put ads on the videos. Doesn't even monetize them. They're just there to watch. You don't want to watch them? Don't watch them. But something was going on. And again, I talk to people, and these videos are changing people's lives. And, you know, this is not some, a lot of the kinds of things that you see in certain corners of Christianity that I don't necessarily have a lot of esteem for. This isn't, you know, Steve Martin's leap of faith. This is a guy giving two-hour videos, rambling, going on rabbit trails, his thoughts that he's developed for years, pretty esoteric, eventually repetitive around certain themes, but these are changing people's lives, and it's sticking. So then there's a sense of euphoria and joy around people, relief for years of depression in some cases. And Jordan Peterson, of course, hears a lot of this, and it's a little awkward for him to talk about. And because, you know, he's tooting his own horn and he doesn't want to say too much. But again, as a minister who's been around a long time and talked to a lot of people watching this phenomenon, you have to say something is happening. And that's why very early on I said, this is something that I as a Christian minister should be paying attention to, because, well, is God involved in this? Is this a revival? I mean, it's a strange thing, and surely not everybody has the same experience. Does Jordan Peterson himself know what he's doing? And I know he has a sense of what he's doing because I sort of asked him that when I had my talk with him back in April. And he certainly knows probably better than anybody else, but I also have a sense that he's kind of stumbled into this and has been feeling his way through it. And if you look at the interview he had with Hainstyle at the beginning of the year, that's pretty much what he talks. It was one step to another, and this seems to work, so I'll do the next thing. And I can really understand that because that's been my experience with this in terms of the videos and the meetups and this tiny little bottle status rocket that I've been on, according to his big giant Saturn V status rocket that he's been on. But you listen to these rambling esoteric lectures to have this result. It is very strange. Now again, if you know a little bit of church history, you know that strange things happen, not just in church history, but in history overall. But this is not unlike some of things that we find in church history. The scale is smaller. Now you might say, what do you mean the scale is smaller? He's got almost 2 million followers, almost 2 million subscribers on YouTube, and maybe a million plus followers on Twitter, and 3 million books sold, and sells out everywhere he goes around the world in venues of 2,500 or 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000. I guess Melbourne was, I'm learning how to say Melbourne in anticipation of my trip. And you know, I guess Melbourne was pretty large. But, you know, Billy Graham used to sell out Yankee Stadium. Billy Graham probably didn't sell tickets. But you get the point that this is big, but it's a big world. And there have been big things in the world. You know, you had the Great Awakening, and you had Jonathan Edwards and some of the things that followed that. And George Whitefield, and he would preach to crowds of 20,000. And go back and read some of the stories out of those movements and the manifestations and all the interesting things that happened. You had the Azusa Street Mission revival that happened and the spread of Pentecostalism in the 20th century all around the world. I mean, some really dramatic stuff. But in many ways, that was all stuff that I was pretty prepared for because I believe in the power of God and I believe in the Holy Spirit and God works through people in lots of interesting and different ways. And so when you've got something that's so big as God, well, you expect big things. But the Jordan Peterson stuff has just been interesting and, again, surprising because you seem to understand better if you have a Billy Graham or if you have an evangelist who's honed his message and he's got his message and you've got the Just As I Am Without One Plea, and you've got the music, and you've got the theatrics, and you're bringing the crowd to a point, and you bring them to a point where they're going to come down the aisle, and they're going to give their life to Christ, and then you've got all your little counselors from the churches so that they can get enfolded. I mean, Christians have been working these programs for a long time, and as those of you who are following, I still got to upload my sermon from this week. Those of you who are following what I'm doing in my preaching, I'm in the beginning of Mark, and Jesus in Mark was just this instant celebrity and on this status rocket and couldn't get a moment's rest because, I mean, people were tearing down his house to get to him and they'd work through the crowd just to touch him to get healing. But again, people listen to Jordan Peterson videos and people who have struggled for years with depression, and many of the people who've talked to me have stories like this. And then they will tell me, when I listen to his videos, the depression lifts. And you just have to say, huh. It's not anywhere near psychological or as theatrical as what you might find in a tent revival or even in a Yankee Stadium-sized Billy Graham revival. And there's something about YouTube in this too, because, you know, you go to Jordan Peterson's live events and they're not like a revival. They're pretty staid. People are excited. People are remarkably well behaved, as Peterson mentions. People are excited to be there. The most interesting part of those events is frankly the VIP sections afterwards, and I just probably pumped sales to those. And there's a sense in which, yeah, it's a little annoying. You and 150 of your closest stranger friends are gonna stand in line for 30 seconds to shake the great man's hand, but you do it. And the most remarkable thing about it is that in those 30 seconds, you very much have the and talk to James, who teaches psychology, has a PhD in psychology. A couple of other therapists went me to the Sacramento one last June. All of us who are used to dealing with people, and we watch Jordan Peterson go through that line of 150 people, and every single person for the 30 seconds or a minute that you had his attention, he gave you his undivided attention. And as Scott Alexander notes, the blogger Star Slate Codex, I always get that wrong, is a remarkable psychologist. He's a remarkable therapist. You see that when you watch that. So, he certainly is charismatic, but he is also this is why all of the Owen Benjamin and similar complaints about him, that he's a con man and a, it just doesn't ring true to me, because at some point, if you're a con man, the mask has to slip. And if he's a con man, he's the best I've ever seen. And he's working an incredibly long con because, well, is he making money from this? Sure, I don't begrudge him any of that. Nobody makes you go buy his book. Nobody makes you go to the theater. Nobody makes you cough off the extra money for the VIP ticket. But for that 30 seconds or a minute. I mean, he recognized me when he saw me. Well, that's because I know out there in YouTube land, oh, that's because you're making videos about him. But hey, my channel's what? 10,000 subscribers? That's a lot for me. But in YouTube land, it's not that much. It's not much at all. And so, I'm not a big wheel, but there's something in this. And again, I know people have, a lot of people have written me, I don't listen to his lectures anymore. Oh, he repeats himself. Oh, I've heard what he has to say. This phenomenon is real and important. And again, just the fact that more than one, more than 10 people have told me, either on video chat or via email, stories like, it wasn't until I started listening to his biblical series that pow, the depression lifted and I saw the world in a whole new way. And you think, how on earth are those lectures doing that? That is remarkable. And I don't want this moment to pass without someone marking this and testifying to this, that something is happening. And this is why a lot of people are like, well, when's he going to do the biblical lectures again? And maybe he'll do Exodus and, lightning won't strike twice. That could very well be. Maybe 10 more rules or 12 more rules will be a dud. And 12 Rules for Death would have been a heck of a lot more interesting book. I don't know. But Peterson continues to surprise. I don't count this man out very quickly. But again, my point for this video, people watch these lectures, 2 hours of this man rambling about the Bible, and they are healed from depression. Not everybody, mostly men. Why is that? It's remarkable. As I mentioned before, reading through Michael Pollan's How to Change Your Mind, and I kind of stopped in it because some other books replaced it in the hierarchy. One of the things that I noted through Pollan's book, though, was this use of the word sacrament. And actually, all the way back into the 60s, Timothy Leary uses this word to describe psychedelics. Why? And in my last video, towards the end of the video, I had the realization, meaning is Peterson sacrament. Well, what do I mean by a sacrament? A sacrament is that which connects you to the thing behind it, that which connects you to the most real world. In my Calvinist tradition, it's the real presence. This gets articulated by transubstantiation in the Roman Catholic tradition. The I don't respect the Zwinglian position on the Lord's Supper, that what a sacrament is joins two worlds. And for Peterson, meaning or responsibility, Strawn thought responsibility, and he's got a point, so I threw that in there. But meaning for Peterson is a sacrament. It joins us to the other world. And just today, another video dropped, Higher Ed and Our Culture Inflection Moment. And again, I listened to this, and the education conversation is a conversation about a symptom, not the cause. And for Peterson, he's worked in higher education all his life. It's very legitimate for him for that to be the center of his concern, just as it's legitimate for me for the church to be the center of my concern and this aspect to be the center of my concern. And they had a very interesting conversation about the particular and the infinite. And I think about that in terms of my phrase, you know, the age of decay, because one of the things that happens in this age, because the Bible tells time in two ages. There's the age, the New Testament talks about it in a variety of ways. The age of sin and death. I call it the age of decay. It's the time where moth and rust consume. Jesus admonishes in a very actual age representation, store up your treasures in heaven where moth and rust do not consume. Because in this age, Dan Fogelberg asks, how can we make love stay? Well, what's Dan Fogelberg singing about? Maybe that song, reference to that song is Dating Me. Go ahead and look it up on YouTube and you can hear Dan Fogelberg's how can we make love stay? Another old song, Jim Croce, Time in a Bottle. If I could put time in a bottle, it's all the same thing. You have the particular and the infinite. And what a sacrament does is connects the moment to the infinite. And I like the part of the discussion where they're talking about the fact that the every moment, every instant, everything in the world is a connection through. Okay? And I know that sounds mystical, it sounds mysterious. It's by no means unchristian, because it's quite frankly, in my belief, it's the second part of the song of the angels in the temple at the beginning of the book of Isaiah. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty. That is, to me, the reason why pantheism isn't true. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty. He is separate and apart from everything, but the whole earth is full of his glory, which means that through almost anything, his glory points us to him. That's sacramental. So let's jump into a bit of this. This just dropped today, but very interesting conversation. Peterson had it on his own channel.
Because of the restrictions that are part and parcel of your existence, but maybe you have your room, and you might think, you might have contempt for that, and so it's a complete bloody catastrophe. But you don't have to. You could think, well, I've got a little... It isn't a room, it's a place of potential. And as soon as you know that, then it's not your room anymore. It isn't a room. The room that you see is your preconception of the space that you inhabit.
And again, now we're into deep Petersonianism in terms of understanding. See, Strawn is colonizing me, and I'm going to get you on this channel. You know who I'm talking to. Your room isn't, it's deep potential. The whole earth is full of his glory. The earth is full of potentiality. Your room is full of potentiality.
What's there is a fragment of infinity. That's what's there. And what you see is the low resolution consequence of your assumption and lazy habit and blindness.
And now here, I think, even though Peterson has never mentioned Thomas Nagel, Peterson, I think, in this is working on Thomas Nagel's project, because the West got a lot of mileage by excluding the subjective and trying to, and playing the game of the monarchical vision that, okay, we can only deal with the objective, but as Thomas Nagel, I think, has pointed out correctly, that's at its limits. And so the subjective has to be reintroduced into the conversation, and that's exactly what Peterson is doing here.
That's your initial room, and you think, well, no, that's not the room. See, part of what artists do, for example, when Van Gogh paints a room, and you look at it glowing, he's trying to show you what's beyond your perception of the room. And I mean this technically, like the way that your visual system is set up is that whenever memory and presumption can replace direct perception, it will, because it's simpler. So you literally see what you expect to see. And if what you see is dull and drab and boring and pointless and uninspiring, then that's you. It's not what's there. And what the artist does when he or she re-represents that mundane reality is to remind you of what's behind it.
And now again, when you listen to this stuff, you have to say, well, first of all, a lot of people listening to this are going to say, what the heck is he talking about? But it's this kind of stuff that's changing people's lives. That's totally bizarre.
The potential that's there. And so what I'm suggesting to people is that they take the potential that's right in front of them. It's like, okay, and here's the rule. You're aiming up. There's something that you could change, that you would change. That might be a very small thing. Could, well, that's within the grasp of your power. Would is within the grasp of your will. To combine those two things might be a very small shift. You might only be willing to make a very tiny step forward. It's like, fine, good enough. Make a tiny step forward. And that makes you a slight bit stronger than you were before. And then the next step can be slightly larger. And it's the path of humility. It's what people act out. So there's this cathedral. It's not a cathedral. It's an oratorio in Montreal. I think it's the second largest one in the world. It's set on a hill, at the top of a hill. And there's a huge staircase leading up to it from the bottom of the hill. And people often who are crippled and who are on crutches and so forth or in wheelchairs go there and make their way painfully up the hill. Or maybe they do that on their knees. And the idea is that they're struggling incrementally uphill, step by step, despite their burdens, to reach the city of God on the hill. And they're acting out. That's life. It's like the proper aim is the city of God on the hill.
They said it twice. I heard you.
And what is that? Well, that's that place that we talked about already, where these levels of responsibility are stacked together harmoniously so that you're acting in your best interest and in your family's best interest and in the world's best interest. And I would say in the best interests of reality itself, right? Assuming that we have some integral role to play in reality, which is certainly at least true at the human level. That's the city of God on the hill that beckons to everyone. And you move up that, you move towards that humbly. So that's one step at a time. And you do it despite your burden and your suffering, all of that. And that's all dramatized in that. And it's a perfect drama of that.
And would you even say it's not simply despite your suffering, it's in and through your particular suffering. I mean, one thing that strikes me about, you know, clean up your room, clean up your room.
Yes.
The affirmation of the particularity.
Now they're doing Bible study.
Of your life. I mean, one thing that strikes me about deepest in our human experience is that it is infinitely particular. I mean, that you mentioned your granddaughter. I mean, the loves, the people, the experiences, the places that we're shaped by, they're not places in the abstract. This top-down sense as if there could be the same kinds of clothes and the same kinds of experience for all human beings. That's the enemy of the very deepest truth of our human experience, which it seems to me is infinitely particular, but not infinitely particular in the sense in which those particularities just go all off into nothingness. Those particulars are precisely our points of access,
right,
to the transcendent,
right. Right.
To the infinite, to that
that's
which...
That's where the reality is.
Yes.
Yeah, well,
yes.
So that's...
And this is, if you go back and look at C.S. Lewis's comment in... It's in A Severe Mercy to Sheldon Van Auken about real things. I think it's in Severe Mercy. And about why Lewis opted for Christianity rather than Hinduism because real things, you know, something real like my cell phone stand, real things scale like that. And this can just be a little humble cell phone stand that I bought on Amazon quite a few years ago for $5 or $6, but it scales all the way to the infinite, and you can even see glory in this cell phone stand.
That's why Jung said that modern men can't see God because they don't look low enough.
Yes.
They're not paying attention to the importance of the particularities. Because the particularity is where the pen meets the paper, right?
Yes.
And it's just a tiny dot every like when you're writing, it's a dot, and then it extends into a line, and those transform into words and sentences and paragraphs. But the particular act is where the pen meets the paper.
Yes. Yes.
That's that focal point, right?
Yes.
That's the center of the cross, by the way. It's the same thing.
Yes. Well, you mentioned the cross. I mean, certainly in the history of the West, one of the ways this comes through is, and in the East too, is in Christian theology, is the very notion of the incarnation. You know, what is that to say? But that the infinite is in the particular, and that they are co-inherent. That the infinite, in fact, has no life except in the particular, and the particular itself has a relation to or is comprehended by that very infinite. And so it seems to me that what is going on there is an affirmation that every particularity, no matter how tiny, itself is revelatory of a transcendent and deep reality.
I think it was from the Gospel of Thomas, but I might have this wrong. The kingdom of God is spread upon the earth, but men do not see it. And that's that infinite possibility in each moment of particularity. And that is what great artists are reminding us of. They'll take a slice of space and time. Was it Monet who painted the haystacks? He went out into the fields in France, and he painted the same haystack like many, many times under different conditions of lighting. And to show how different it, like if it's a haystack, it's the same thing.
Yes.
But it wasn't. He paid attention to the particularities. And so what great artists are trying to do is, well, first of all, so imagine a painting. So it's a painting of a landscape. And so the first thing is that it's layers of time, because the painter has gone out there and seen the landscape and then seen it again and then seen it again and then seen it again and then seen it again, and has to pay attention to the particularities of the light and the color and all of that to represent it properly. So it's and the mere fact that he's done that is it's the acting out of the idea that in this tiny slice of time and space there's something worth attending to for an infinite amount of time. But you can't, because you just can't do it. But you need to know that you could.
Because you can't do it.
Do it, and then it would be worthwhile. And so
if you could do it, it would be worthwhile. But you can't.
Painter encapsulates the landscape and then frames it and says, like, look through this window at the transcendent that's behind the low resolution representation of your assumption, the blindness that you, the
hear that again. Now you're some of you might, but what do you mean by sacramental?
Look through this window at the transcendent that's behind the low resolution representation of your assumption.
That's in many ways what the sacrament is. Hear it again.
That's look through this window at the transcendent that's behind the low resolution representation of your assumption, the blindness that you, the expedient blindness that you by necessity bring to bear to every situation. Remember what's behind this. Always remember what's behind this. And that's what art calls us to do. That's what beauty calls us to do, is to make contact with that. And then you say, well, the problem with the particularity is that it brings suffering. And the bringing of suffering with particularity can also allow evil to enter the world, because that particular suffering can engender bitterness and resentment and hatred and all of those things, and the desire to destroy. So the particularity carries with it a tremendous risk and a tremendous burden. And so the answer, the question is, well, how do you tolerate the particularity and take advantage of the potential? And the answer is to make a relationship with the infinite that's behind the particularity. And that's the fundamental religious idea, is to if you can maintain the particularity, but also stay in contact with what's transcendent and infinite beyond that, then you can, then you have the potential strength to tolerate the catastrophe of, yes, of what's limited.
Yeah.
And I don't know why I didn't say that to Sam Harris, because that's a pretty good, that's a pretty good assertion right there of your relationship with God, number two. Let me back it up.
And they make the bridge destroy. So the particularity carries with it a tremendous risk and a tremendous burden. And so the answer, the question is, well, how do you tolerate the particularity and take advantage of the potential? And the answer is to make a relationship.
To make a relationship. What do you mean, make a relationship? Well, that's how you do it. You make a relationship
with the infinite that's behind the particularity. And that's the fundamental religious idea, is to, if you can maintain the particularity, but also stay in contact with what's transcendent and infinite beyond that, then you can, then you have the potential strength to tolerate the catastrophe of,
yeah,
of, yes, what's limited.
Yeah.
And of course, in Christianity, you say, well, I've got to make a relationship with a particularity. I'm going to make a relationship. Ricola, our little product placement for today. No, I'm going to make this bag that I ripped because, you know, I needed a cough drop at some point. Well, Book of Colossians says Jesus is the icon of the invisible God. He is the particularity of the God, Hotheos. You make a relationship with that. You make a relationship through it. Well, what is the sacrament? Well, it's the, Jesus calls his disciples together and says, this is my body given for you. This is my blood shed for you. And you can see, bang. Now, why does this work? Why do we need it? Why did the old things pass? You know, I think about the distributists, Mencius Moldbug, Why the Left Keeps on Winning video. And there's this technological disruption that keeps moving things forward. And in a thing, in a sense, so you say, okay, it's all of this suffering. And so then I always bring my question, why was it that when I was working with Haitians who have incredibly difficult lives, I never heard of suicide? But then we come to North America and we have people who are affluent and have very easy lives, they succumb to nihilism and depression. Why is that? Well, again, you look at Peterson and you have to say, well, meaning. Responsibility is a sacrament. It's a sacrament to what? It's a sacrament to who you were made to be. What's interesting in the story of the garden in Genesis 2 is that they're given responsibility, but it's fruitful responsibility. And in the curses that are handed out in Genesis 3 at the rebellion, when they say, oh, I'll do it on my own, it's like, okay, here, I'll make it harder for you. Now, the ground is going to fight you. And then when Cain, after Cain kills Abel, the ground cries out. The ground rebels against Cain again because he had been a farmer. He had produced fruit. He had produced food from the earth. And God says, now the earth isn't going to give you anything. And so he goes and builds a city. Well, what is a city? A city is, well, now you're no longer having to directly. He goes from being a farmer to a city dweller. That's what happens in Cain with his story. So, you know, all of this stuff is, again, built into that story. Well, now here we go developing. We're more and more affluent. We're more and more disconnected. We're more and more disconnected from the particularity. And we have our lovely computer games to get us into the flow state. And even though we can get into a flow state, the gnawing, without the sacrament of meaning and responsibility, we sink. Look at the fall of the Roman Empire. The framework of the church with the fall of the Roman Empire was the only stable institution that could keep things from degenerating into chaos. Only they could broker between the warring Christian and pagan barbarian groups that fed off the carcass of the Roman Empire. And even as those groups fed off its carcass, it tried to appropriate its glory by taking on Roman language and Roman symbols and Roman titles. And, you know, everyone was, it was the Holy Roman Empire was in Europe. And of course, the Holy Roman Empire was not holy. It was not Roman, and it was not an empire. It was sort of an empire. And then, of course, the monastic movement comes along, and what the monastic movement offers are structure and rules of life. It offered a structure even when the Roman family, governed by the paterfamilias, was in tatters. That whole structure, that whole slave state structure of Rome just collapses, and there are no structures, and then the church moves in and becomes the structure, and really the parent for a thousand years while Europe recovers from Rome and heads then into the late Middle Ages and then into the Enlightenment and the colonial Renaissance, Enlightenment, colonial period. But here's the challenge. So, okay, so a lifetime of room cleaning? How much focus can you keep with all of this stuff? And what you begin to recognize is, wow, I've watched these videos and my depression has lifted and I've cleaned my room. And you realize that, okay, now you do your Piaget and scale and you realize, all right, this little bit of potential that I have taken mastery of, all right, my room is clean. Well, what's next? Well, what you discover is that there's an infinite amount of mess in your life. Well, how can you sustain this? Plus the fact that, you know, Peterson has you imagining, well, you're going up the stairs, you're getting stronger and stronger, but so on one hand, you've got technology continuing to woo you into greater and greater potentiality, cheaper and cheaper costs. Now I no longer need a movie studio to produce the little Paul Vanderclay show. All I need is this PC and a webcam, and I got a blue microphone here. And poof, through YouTube, I can put it out there. It's a lot less than organizing a studio. The bar is now lower. All right. But also, I am aging. I am decaying. I am getting every passing year, over the grand scheme of things, I get a little less strong. Now I make it up. I get a little more wise, hopefully. I've gained a little bit more knowledge. I've learned a few more things. So, well, now we're getting into something that's very familiar to the Bible. Inside, I'm growing, while outside, I'm decaying. And if you look at those trajectories, well, at some point, you might want to say, well, if that's the case, and all I am is a materialist, there's really nothing I'm seeing through. See, again, Peterson, he plays the sacramental card, but then he pulls back from it. And you just want to say, don't be afraid of Lessing's ditch. Don't be afraid of his ditch. Believe that if the miraculous world that we see today, which is full of his glory, can be here now, and Peterson runs this math, how much better can it get? What if you don't end? What if you don't die? Well, that's scary, and actually Lewis runs that, because he says, on one hand, we're all moving on a trajectory, and we're either getting better and better and better and better, or we're getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And if you watch the Adam conversations we've been having about objective morality and moral order, well, those trajectories are all pointing. They are vectors that point outside the iron box of secularity. And which way are they going? Well, what are you going to need in order to continue to go and grow further? What institutions will you need? Because you can't do it alone. And you need yardsticks in order to measure yourself. What disciplines will you need? You need things that you don't want to do in order to achieve where you want to go. That's what a discipline is. What communities will you need around you? What people will you need to be on the journey with? Because you, in one way, you always do it alone, but in another way, you can never do it alone. What practices will you need? And that, again, connects up with the disciplines, the communities, the institutions. What boundaries will you need? What things in your life must you say no to in order to become what you want to become? You don't find Olympic athletes laying around the couch covered with Cheetos dust. They don't eat like that. Why? Because they've got a bigger goal. Well, where are you going to find these things? So maybe you went to the revival and you sucked down 50 hours of Jordan Peterson videos. And while you were sucking down those videos, the depression was at bay and the nihilism was away from you. Well, good. Well, many of you have discovered there's a law of diminishing returns. You watched it again, and you watched it again, and you watched it again. And at some point, you have a chaos order. You've got the explored territory and the unknown territory. Well, now it's all explored territory. You think, well, I need to keep growing. Well, here are your questions. What institutions do you need? What disciplines do you need? What communities do you need? What practices do you need? What boundaries do you need? Who will you submit to? Those are really the questions. And if you want to keep cleaning your room, metaphorically, you're going to need to answer those questions.